The short story, The Warning. It was one of the few times I actually sat on my front stoop, but it would prove to be memorable. As I sat there basking in the hot summer sun, I couldn't get the lyrics of the Rascals' Summer in the City out of my head, back of my neck, dirty and gritty. My daydream was interrupted by a harsh, strange voice. "You the guy hassling the girls?" I looked up to see a man in his early 30s standing on the sidewalk, which led to my front steps. "I beg your pardon," I answered. "I've been told you're the guy giving the girls some shit." He was right. I was the guy that was giving the girls some shit, as he put it. In fact, I'd been making a practice of discouraging the business of prostitution on our street. For example, Maggie and I had been disabling payphones in the neighborhood by cutting phone cables on our nightly commando raids. Before cellular phones, telephone booths were often the offices for pimps and drug dealers. Another way to discourage business was to photograph Johns, men who bought sex, when they attempted to negotiate a purchase. Suburban males and our Canadian brothers from Windsor across the river made up the majority of their trade. Oddly enough, Sunday was the biggest day for business. Johns driving a station wagon or a van sporting a child's car seat and a set of golf clubs in the back were a common sight. You see, they were usually married with children, no pun intended, and they told their wives they were shooting a round of golf. The sex they bought was usually oral and performed right in the John's car, in full view of the golf clubs, the child's car seat, and anyone who happened by, or in my case, anyone who jogged by. I guess it's why I developed the practice of looking in parked cars as I made my daily run. It helped to take my mind off the pain of running 10 or more miles each day. But it wasn't this practice that led me to this confrontation with my visitor. There was an unwritten neighborhood law that girls would not cross Alexandrin Street to sell their wares. However, recently, a group of new young pimps had decided that this old agreement was keeping them from business. So they chose to move their girls across Alexandrin Street and work the block directly in front of our house. It was then that I decided that this was a job for Al Kaline. Well, actually, my Al Kaline autographed Louisville Slugger baseball bat, which I went to the street to win the great Second Avenue hooker war. I simply informed any girl working on our street that I would have to break their legs if they insisted on crossing the imaginary line, and that would be difficult to work with broken legs. Pretty harsh, but we're fighting for every inch to make the corridor a place for people to live, and we couldn't afford to give up a whole block. Knife fights were becoming routine, even in the aisles of the Tomboy Market. You have to understand that I hadn't had a fight since the fourth grade, so this was a real departure for me. However, the corridor had a way of changing you. The irony of this was that we were trying to change the neighborhood, and the neighborhood was gradually changing us. "I'm not hassling anybody," I responded to my visitor. "Bullshit. We know you've been giving them shit, and you're hurting our business. And when our business gets hurt, we hurt. And then we hurt you. Dig?" The message was pretty clear. He was definitely delivering me a warning. I knew he meant business. I also knew that many of the girls had been disposed of by being thrown off buildings when they displeased their pimps. And I also knew I had displeased them. He glared at me, waiting for a response. "Listen, asshole, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the more girls you send across Alexandrin, the more complaints the 13th Precinct is going to get, and the more complaints bring more policemen, and maybe, just maybe, there are folks down here, including me, who don't want any police down here nosing around in things we don't want them to be nosing around about. You dig?" My visitor looked at me and smiled. "I dig. You're doing some shit." Did I say that? I guess I did, or at least He thought I did, and it seemed to satisfy him. I smiled back at him, and then he tapped the back of my hand in a closed fist as if he were greeting a brother and said, "Leave the ball bat at home, and the girls will be gone. One more thing. Get rid of that motherfucking camera, because I'd hate to have to kill you, but I will." With that, he smiled, turned, and walked away. Did this really happen? It was like a slow-motion dream that seemed to be over before I could respond with any noticeable fear. My first response was anger. He angered me, and I responded accordingly. I can actually say that I wasn't scared then, when it was happening. To be honest, it didn't hit me until later, much later. Was this a death threat if I didn't change my ways? If he wanted to kill me, he could have done it then and there. But this was definitely a warning, my first, and I wondered if it would be my last. For the next several weeks, I was followed on my nightly runs by a car I presume contained my visitor or his associates. They never harassed me. They only followed me, making sure that their presence was known. In fact, on one occasion, I actually shouted at them that I was running to Tiger Stadium just in case they wanted to follow. I started to understand how it was that people would kill over the choice of what television show to watch. People who had no power, no choice, no rights. The decision as to what program to watch may be the only decision over which they had any control. People who had been pushed so far that there was no turning back, no more space to give up. I didn't take this death threat lightly, but I also felt pushed with no room left to give. If I showed fear or let them win this battle, the war was surely going to be lost. My home and business were here, and this was now my neighborhood, and I wasn't going to give it up without a fight. The Cass Corridor was now home, and my home was worth fighting for.